And welcome to this edition of the Healthy Planet Radio Program. My name is Bob DiBenedetto, your host for the best hour of your life. That's right, the one that's always in front of you, right now. The Healthy Planet focuses on topics that will help to educate you about the deep connection among all life on Earth and the powerful effects your everyday choices can have on creating a clean, healthy, and compassionate world. One of the things I really love after doing this show for more than 14 years is coming across a topic that I know is important and that I know has the ability to transform our planet in a really positive way. And when you put that together with a topic that's also really engaging and so much taken for granted, to the point that as important and urgent as it is, it's rarely discussed. And here we are. We've got such a topic tonight. And it is topsoil. And yes, that's right. Topsoil can be engaging and interesting. And you'll understand why I say that once you've heard this show and once you've heard our guest, who is the director and producer of a recent film entitled The Need to Grow. The critical role of topsoil is something that we started teaching about in 1990. When we started our nonprofit organization. And the person who brought this to the fore all the way back then was John Robbins, who wrote Diet for a New America. And the information in his book actually forms the basis for the work we did for many years. He had a very powerful chapter on topsoil and the way our modern agriculture was causing it to actually become depleted rapidly, to the point that we were endangering our survival. And that's because topsoil plays many important ecological roles, not the least of which is as the medium in which we grow food. And if you haven't seen this film yet, I highly recommend you do. It'll really change your understanding of the planet we live on and give you a much more comprehensive idea of what it takes for our food system to not only survive, but to thrive. There are solutions that are available. And we'll be discussing those momentarily, because we're going to be interviewing a solutions-oriented person who created a solutions-oriented film, who is very much involved with this issue in the present day. He's director and producer of the award-winning film, The Need to Grow, and his name is Rob Herring. Hey, thanks for joining us on The Healthy Planet, Rob.
Excellent. Thank you for having me, Bob. Excited to be here and to chat about this topic that needs to become even more important and focused on than ever before.
We need to talk about it. Because if we're not talking about it, nobody's talking about it.
Exactly. And
speaking of John Robbins, you are associated with John and Ocean's Food Revolution Network. So we're making a full circle here from where I started working on these issues overall with animal agriculture and with the topic of this show.
Yeah, it's amazing to see the interconnectedness, I think, of this work. And it's beautiful to see how these things are synergistic. And it's a bit of a smaller world, right? That old cliche. But, those of us who are doing this kind of work, it's those collaborations, I think, are also so important.
They are. And it's bound to come around. And I think in the original organization, the tagline was, we're all connected. So there you go.
Perfect.
So if you were to ask most people what was needed to sustain human life on Earth, they'd likely say air, water, food. But topsoil, the focus of your film, The Need to Grow, is something that I guarantee that most in the non-farming U.S. population would not have considered as being one of the necessary components of our survival on this planet. It's just in the background. It produces our food, but we don't think of it as our food. So we hope to change that in the next 45 minutes, as we'll be discussing some of the eye-opening facts on topsoil, the challenges we're facing with our growing lands, and there are challenges, as well as some of the solutions that we're able to talk about and put forth as a possibility going forward. So let's start with the challenges. The opening shot of your film states, we have an estimated 60 years of farmable soil left on our planet, mostly due to unsustainable agriculture. It goes on to say that Earth has lost a third of its farmable soil in the last 40 years. Explain what farmable soil is and why it's so important to life on Earth.
Yeah, great question. So I think the the basis here is just understanding this difference between a concept of dirt and soil. And oftentimes they get lumped in as one thing, right? So dirt is just sort of the media, the opportunity for life to exist, whereas soil is dirt in combination with all of these billions and trillions of microbes. And so these microbes that, of course, are invisible to the naked eye, we've got a few of the critters in the soil that we can see, but for so long, it's been easy to ignore this magical cosmic level of interaction that's happening underneath our feet. And so these are tens of thousands of different species that are working together, are competing in some regards, but are ultimately exchanging the flow of nutrients from one form to another and making it available for plants. And so there's synergy that happens with plant roots and these microbes, and they all perform so many different functions. And one thing that's really just humbling is that, you know, even the top soil scientists will admit we barely know really what's happening down there. I mean, we might understand 1%, if that, and that may even be a bit of an arrogant assumption, I think, because of just so much complexity that hasn't really been studied as much as I hope there will be in the future. And so, you know, it really is like a cosmic level of information that we've yet to dive into. And we know more about the stars than we literally do about our own soil, which is kind of fascinating to think about. And yet these soil microbes are really the basis for all of our life. So when we do farming in a way that is, you know, destructive to the biology that's happening there, and when we think of farming as just sort of a chemical approach and not a biological approach, then we're losing sight of how we, you know, shepherd that life and continue to build that life over time. So the soil dies, for lack of a better word, as these microbes fail and we fail to work with them. We poison them with different pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, and we've stripped a lot of the resources that nature would have normally cyclically put back into those ecosystems. And so the soil becomes dirt. And so it loses its structure, it loses its ability to hold water, and it loses its ability to regulate the nutrients and really the air that we breathe. So I think what we'll get into today is how, you know, those first three topics of air, food, and water that we all think about are actually all regulated by the soil. And it seems like maybe an oversimplification, but in some ways, you know, all of it starts there. And so we can talk about how, you know, soil is the really regulating our nutrient density in the foods that we eat, and therefore affecting our own human health, and how floods or droughts are either prevented or, you know, furthered by the soil life, and how, maybe most importantly, soil can actually be and should be and is the only place for our atmospheric excess carbon to go. Really, the idea is, if we're farming in ways that destroy the life in the soil through tilling and chemical intensive agriculture, then we lose soil. And so it runs off with irrigation. It blows off, as we, you know, famously remember of the Dust Bowl. And basically over time, we're just losing the ability to farm in that soil. So we move out to further and further lands. Historically, we have to chop down more forests. We have to create new agricultural soils through that process, which is, of course, destroying ecosystems. And something like the Amazon rainforest is just, you know, disappearing. But also we are, you know, needing further and further inputs as we go down that negative feedback loop. So as the soil life is being lost, you know, conventional farmers start to feel that they need more inputs, more fertilizers. And of course, those fertilizers, by and large, are coming from petroleum-based sources. So, you know, the nitrogen fertilizer industry has its own problems in just that one category there, which could be a whole deep dive. But is that, you know, it's like relying on any drug where you need a bigger and bigger dose over time. And so we've artificially created the illusion of productivity. What I like to think of as sort of these silhouettes of crops that are all monocultured and ignoring the way that nature does things. And then over time, you just need more and more inputs and more chemicals. And we're just propping up, kind of band-aiding the fact that, you know, our soil is not providing because we have systematically destroyed it, particularly over the last, you know, 40 years or so. We've really accelerated it. So yeah, we need to rebuild that soil. But the beautiful thing, as depressing as all of that can sound, that nature is so resilient. I mean, like mind-bogglingly resilient. No matter how much we beat down the soil, it can actually bounce back really fast. You know, people sometimes think of soil as taking thousands of years for an inch of topsoil to be created is kind of a misnomer, but it's looking at it from the approach of geologically, you know, as erosion would happen on rock and minerals and such, then it would take all of this, you know, thousands and thousands of years for soil to be created. But the fact is, farmers can regenerate their topsoil quickly in just a couple of years, 2 to 3 years even. We've seen some pretty amazing things. That only happens when we really cultivate that life.
Yeah, and one of the things from this film that I liked so much was the depth at which it goes into the topsoil and shows you with animations, with pictures, and also with actual seeing the soil and dirt being held in the hand. And when you look at the soil, you see that it's this dark, rich, it just feels like life. There are worms roaming around all over the place and it's alive. And then you hold the dirt and the farmer is holding the dirt. And it is this dry, crumbly, you could tell there's no life. It's like if you took something and killed it and dried it out and that's the dirt. And that's what we're trying to grow our crops on now. And again, as you mentioned, it's like a cocaine addict. They say, okay, I'm going to stay awake 23 hours every day, and I'm going to take this drug every day. And you keep doing that. It's like, oh, I'm getting so much productivity and so much. And there is the productivity of more and more chemical agriculture. But there is a crash coming, and it is inevitable. And that's where we are today.
Yeah, and it's really already happening, you know, so much so. And the ripple effects are enormous. It's hard to calculate them. I mean, in many ways, the damage of chemical agriculture hasn't really been calculated. We can estimate certain things, and we can estimate the amount of runoff that happens. You know, and these systems, as you mentioned, you know, we're just needing further and further inputs. And unfortunately, because the life is dwindling in these soils, they can use the nutrients less and less efficiently as we put in these artificial fertilizers. And so it's estimated up to 50% of the nitrogen fertilizers that are added to agriculture don't actually stay there and aren't even used in the process. And so they wash off and they run off, taking with it, of course, all the harmful pesticides. And so those make their way into our rivers and they wash downstream. And then these nitrogen chemicals have, you know, unfortunate collateral impacts by blooming things like algae that can kind of create an imbalance in ecosystems in places like the Gulf of Mexico, where there's this dead zone, it's called, because algae blooms have gone so rampant that it blocks out the sunlight for the other species, and it takes over and just destroys these areas. And so not to mention, you know, the chemicals that are making their way into the water systems, that are making their way into groundwater, that are found then in tap water throughout the country, and the farmers that are being exposed, which is really just starting to come to light in these past couple of years as a few farmers have had, you know, verdicts in their favor showing causation of certain chemicals to, you know, the health concerns that they've had. So there's just so many reasons why, you know, switching to regenerative and organic and biodynamic farming systems are really looking out for everyone along the whole supply chain, you know, the farmers themselves, the ecosystems, the biodiversity, and the butterflies and the bees and the birds that are on these farms or should be on these farms that have been driven off. And then, of course, us as the consumers. And so, and then wildlife at large, which, you know, so there's really just, you know, it's like pick the thing that you're passionate about and realize that it's not a political issue. You know, it's not a hippy dippy thing. It's really about how do we sustain agriculture as an industry. And food is, you know, one of the few great equalizers, right? We all are born and die. We all need food and water and basically shelter as well. But really, when food runs out, not much else is going to matter. And so how do we protect these systems? And of course, you know, work on all the other issues that our society is struggling with at this time. But keeping in mind that, you know, not much is going to be possible to even debate when there's no food and there's no water. And both of those things come back to our soil and how we treat our soil.
Yeah, and you look at the issue that we're discussing today with topsoil, and you add on top of that the issue of climate change, where we are objectively in a really deep hole right now, where there could conceivably be billions of refugees as a result of melting glaciers and lack of fresh drinking water. There could be billions of refugees as the result of rising sea levels. And between droughts and rising sea levels and extreme weather and wildfires. And then here's the interesting part. We're talking about this and we're called the radicals because we're focusing on something that is itself very radical. We are absolutely the conservatives. So, you know, it should be couched that way. And it's funny that conservative politics means that we're willing to throw anything and everything related to nature away and assume that man, specifically man, can do it better. And it just doesn't work. Those damn radicals.
Yeah. I mean, you know, politics is so even subconsciously interwoven, I think, just with ideas of capitalism and things like this. And so, you know, exploiting anything and everything for the quote unquote American dream or, you know, to build a business is, you know, these things are really interwoven. And
short-term profit.
Yeah. So on this climate change issue, you know, it can be divisive and we've seen that messaging can get really muddied up. And the way that I like to look at it is really it's a pollution issue. And, you know, it's hard for me to find somebody who doesn't want clean air and clean water. And I think if we just return to this idea that, you know, we are creating pollution, and we don't even have to talk about carbon necessarily heating up the planet, but, you know, what are the impacts of the activities that we're doing in terms of, you know, just poisoning our air and water? And of course, you know, if we can get to that part of the conversation about carbon, what has been interesting to me is watching even the environmental movement really focus so much only on emissions and reducing emissions alone. And of course, that's a huge part of the puzzle, but it's almost been eerie, and it's starting to change now a bit, but it's been eerie watching as so few people consider the fact that we've already emitted enough carbon into the atmosphere that would take, you know, an estimated 1,000 years for it to sequester or return back into the land, even if we magically stopped all outputs tomorrow. If all trains, buses, you know, conventional cows, everything, if it all just disappeared, we've already put, you know, this toxic overload of carbon into the atmosphere. So how is that going to reverse? And that's that concept of drawdown. There's a phenomenal book by Paul Hawken called Drawdown and his whole drawdown project. And, you know, that's kind of just where our mind needs to start going, I think, to be focused on the solution. And so the main thing, you know, that is beautiful and is simple is just photosynthesis and just getting people to think in terms of why that's important with soil health. Because as plants are going to be breathing in that carbon, it gets pumped down through their roots into the form of sugars, these carbohydrates that are exchanged to soil microbes. So how do we actually keep it there? And that's the difference between these different forms of agriculture, right? If we have shallow root zone plants only, and we're tilling and tilling. People don't understand yet that tilling in and of itself is taking the carbon that was there in that layer of topsoil, and it's connecting with oxygen in the air, and it becomes CO2 and literally evaporates and drifts off. And it's a bigger contributor to our CO2 emissions than anything else, than transportation. And so it can also be the solution. And so when we, you know, think of soil health as a living organism, we start to implement these strategies like no-till or minimal till or minimal disturbance of soil. And so we really want to maintain soil structure as much as possible. Of course, there are exceptions of times when you just need to till to kind of get things going. But overall, we need to be reducing the disturbance of that soil, because by tilling through these ecosystems, and they're very intricate, and they've built up, you know, the life there. It's almost like a hurricane, you know, blasting through a city. Just on this microcosmic level. And so when we put all of that excess CO2 repeatedly back up into the atmosphere, we've kind of undone the good work that photosynthesis just did on our behalf. So we need to be covering bare soils with as much plant life as humanly possible. And this is a concept called cover crops. And it does a few things. It's sucking down carbon and putting it back into the soils. But it's also acting as a shield, similar to how a mulch would, in that it's preventing further evaporation of water by the sunlight not blasting directly on bare soil. And it's protecting it, you know, in a number of ways through different climate conditions. So having plant life, just more and more and more of it, is part of that simplified way to look at it. And that bare soil needs to be, you know, that's a problem. You know, when you see bare soil, it's like, oh no, that's an opportunity for us to be sucking down carbon. And it doesn't just have to be trees. A lot of people are thinking of forests as really the answer. And trees are, of course, a beautiful way to suck carbon out of the atmosphere and to build their big bulking, you know, tree-like mass that comes from pulling carbon out of the air. But really it's our grasslands that are actually the biggest carbon sink. And how we perform agriculture is going to be the answer. You know, it's going to be whether or not humans can figure this out and we can, you know, keep going, or we're just going to destroy our soil to the point of no return, and unfortunately won't be able to feed anyone and won't be pulling down that carbon. So the answers are there. It's all doable, and it's not even theoretical. People are already doing it. That's the beautiful thing. It's more an awareness issue, and I think a political pressure issue of just putting these kind of and when I say political pressure, also I mean consumer pressure, you know, demanding from the products that we buy, you know, what type of agriculture are you doing? Are you participating in a destructive system, or are you funding regenerative agricultural practices, which is such a beautiful thing to find, you know, companies and brands that are doing that, because you know that you're voting for the good work that can quite literally, you know, save humanity. It sounds hyperbolic, but it really is coming to that. And we need people to understand that, you know, we could switch to solar and electric this and electric that and do zero waste this and that. But if we don't change our relationship to soil, sadly, none of those efforts are going to matter. It's the only way that we can rebalance this carbon imbalance. But nature's got all the tools. We just need to follow her wisdom.
Yep. Get out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
It's there. The wisdom is there. The practices are there. And we call it conventional agriculture, but it's anything but conventional. It's something that we've created in the last 75 years or so. And here we are using it and thinking that it's just the norm when there's nothing normal about it, throwing all these chemicals onto the planet year after year after year, and then expecting things to be normal. Well, we've killed the ecosystem that has created our food historically. And when we don't do that historically, there's been precedence in history that it's destruction of the topsoil. been behind the demise of many ancient civilizations.
Yes, there's a great book called Dirt, The Erosion of Civilizations. I believe the author's name is David Montgomery, that does document, you know, looking back at, you know, we've talked about obviously soil for food and nutrition, and we're, you know, we're talking about how it's pulling down carbon. It also actually cleans the air in a number of other ways through kind of particulate filtering in a sense. And then, you know, when we look at water systems as the organic matter, or, you know, the life systems in soil increases by just a mere 1 percentage point, let's say in an acre, you know, that acre can store an estimated 25,000 more gallons of water. And it's because the porosity and the soil structure is acting more like a sponge. So from a water standpoint, you know, when it rains, is that soil actually absorbing and holding it there? Or is it just flooding and all of that water is washing away and taking with it the top layer of soil and those chemical inputs? Or if it infiltrates and it sucks it up there, well, now it's not just preventing the flood, but it's also then preventing the drought, or it's more drought tolerant on the back end. And so, you know, there are many examples of farmers who are doing regenerative practices in side by side with their neighbors who aren't, that, you know, in heavy rains are not experiencing the flooding, and then in the dry seasons are not experiencing the droughts. These are people in the exact same microclimates. So these solutions are really powerful from a water standpoint. And in California, where I live, you know, the vast majority of water usage is about agriculture. So we do all these things at home and try to be responsible and limit our water and our showers and this and that. But really it's, and of course those are part of it, but really it's a speck compared to the impact that changing our agricultural paradigms would have. And so all of those things start to add up to, you come to a point where when soil is not productive anymore, you know, think of an ancient civilization, as you're mentioning, well, we need to feed our society, right? So we need to get more resources. So if this land isn't productive, well, I'm going to need to go and start farming on that land over there. And eventually you reach the edge of your society and go, well, dang, I got to start getting more land from somebody else. And you essentially are creating civil unrest, because people, if they can feed their family and they have food, water, and shelter, you know, people are probably going to be okay for the most part, you know, if they're left alone and have their basic necessities met. Well, there's no reason to go to war. But when you realize we need more resources and your neighbor's got them, well, that's a pretty good reason to go to war, because you're now fighting for your own livelihood and your own family. And sadly, that's what, you know, humanity has done repeatedly. And as these civilizations, you know, start to try to invade, is really rooted back to their ability to manage resources. And if they had sufficient resources, you know, there's less incentive to go out there and fight with your neighbors. So it really even is at that big level of, you know, soil actually causing the destruction of civilizations. I mean, if you can imagine, you know, what would a United States do if its soils were no longer productive? And we're already relying on so many imports, right, from foods from all over the world. And if our soils just stop producing, well, we're just going to pay more and more money for, you know, more and more imports. And eventually somebody goes, well, I can't give you these imports. We got to feed our people. You know, it's like, you screwed up your soil. You know, then what happens then? And it's a sad thing to think about, because we would start demanding it with force. You know, that would probably be the inevitable outcome. And so protecting our soils is really a national security issue, in my opinion.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
It is one of the most patriotic things we could do. And, you know, that's going to be the future of any nation at this point, just because of how much agriculture has destroyed topsoils all over the world, is that I think the countries that are going to adopt these strategies that are more in line with nature are going to be the ones that are going to be like, hey, you know, you guys are going to fight amongst yourselves, but we're okay. You know, we've got what we need. And so the more communities that they hop on board, you know, the more that we can think about local, because that's where change can happen a lot easier, right? You know, top-down stuff does need to happen, but you can actually get these things going in your own community, in your own state, and it's in your own city. And it's much easier for the little guys like us, you know, to implement and put pressure on those local authorities, because you can actually get to them in some cases, right? You can actually talk to them, you can actually write to them, put the pressure on. And it's harder to do, you know, the bigger you get, like trying to do it from a national standpoint, which let's hope that regenerative agriculture gets implemented in some bigger ways. But I think what we can do is try to push for it, push for organic. It's like step one, removing these chemicals from the exposure that we're seeing to even children on playgrounds and schools that are spraying these toxic pesticides. And that's kind of step one. Just, we need to stop destroying the life in the soil with these chemicals. And of course, we see these impacts happening on people as well, because we're microbial beings as well. And that's also a new part of, you know, the health paradigm that is starting to change lately, as people understand the concept of our own human microbiome and how we're actually outnumbered by these trillions of bacterial species that live on and inside of our gut. And when that gets out of balance, just like the soil, it's a beautiful analogy, because as we destroy those microbes inside of our own soil and inside of our gut, you know, we're seeing terrible health effects.
Yeah, look what happens.
Yep.
And you mentioned about the water usage in California, and it is over 90% for agriculture and about close to 50% for animal agriculture alone. That's in California. And it's true. When they have a drought, they don't tell people, well, we're going to stop raising animals. No more dairy cows. It's all about turn your shower off. Don't brush your teeth. Leave the water running. Minute compared to these other uses. And in the film, you actually discuss, we're talking about The Need to Grow, the film that's available now. And we'll talk about how you can see that shortly. It states that more than one third of fossil fuels, one half of all water, and 80% of our farmland are used in the raising of animals and the plants that feed them. And so you can't really discuss whether it's topsoil loss or any other environmental problem without discussing what type of food we're eating. And in this case, we're talking about the greatest contributors to most of the environmental issues on our planet is animal agriculture.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, and it's the way that it's done more than anything. You know, we're not going to get the world to stop eating meat overnight. I think the paradigm shift that needs to happen is not so much of a binary one, but moving the pendulum more towards the systems that are mindful of their impact on soil health, and moving away from these conventional factory farm models, what people call the CAFOs, that are confined animal feeding operations, where it's definitely the most horrific thing that humans have done. It's one of these things that I think people are just willfully ignorant to and don't want to look at and face the fact that it is so depressing, and it's too embarrassing, I think, for us to actually come to terms with what we've done to other species that we live on this planet with. Yeah. In the name of providing food. And so, yeah, I mean, with California, you know, part of it is how the fragility of our systems, or how centralized things are. You know, so much is coming out of one region, which is a problem in and of itself. And of course, we have to ship these things across the country. But yeah, it's we're waking up to it, I think, in the midst of the most recent crises, which are pointing to how, you know, we need more resilience in our local access, and urban agriculture is a beautiful thing. And it's not one thing or the other. It's, you know, using all of these solutions in harmony. We like to say, you know, it's not a silver bullet, it's a silver buckshot, in that we, you know, we have to be doing all of these things at the same time, and not necessarily getting into these arguments of, oh, well, you know, hydroponics or aquaponics or this or that, you know, indoor vertical farming. I think a lot of these things can supplement each other. The fact is, we have to feed a lot of people in cities. How do we get it as close to cities as possible, doing the least damage? Because the fact is, you know, just living on this planet, we have an impact. So it's not about how do you just shrink your footprint forever to the point of non-existing, because we're all exhaling CO2. Let's be honest, we're all contributing to climate change just by breathing. So, you know, it's not about feeling guilty about every single choice that you make. It's about having a mindful journey towards a better handprint that you're leaving, you know, using the impact that you have in the best way that could ensure that there's future resources for future generations. And so at this time, you know, when just this week in California, in Los Angeles, we had record heat, you know, it's,
oh yeah,
I feel like it's a broken record that not just me and a lot of people, of course, have been saying for so long is, you know, it's not just gonna, this isn't just a fluke year, right? It's just every year in our summers, we have these terrifying wildfires that are going out of control, and the heat just becomes more and just harder and harder to live in. I mean, we're forced to blast our air conditioning at max to the point where, you know, we have city blackouts. Had a blackout just the other day in my apartment. I have friends that are working with us on an important project that have lost power for days because it's so hot. We have no other choice but to rely then on power, which is of course coming from the same fossil fuel system that is leading to this. So it's becoming more and more urgent. And that can sound really scary, but in a way, you know, sometimes when we see the problem more clearly, we hope that when these things become more and more on our doorstep, that people will start to take them seriously. So the question is just, will it be too late? Because it will be inevitable that I think people wake up to these solutions and start realizing, wow, mm-hmm. Yeah, that does make sense. So like putting that, if carbon is causing the problem, as is methane and nitrous oxide and these other greenhouse gases that aren't getting as much PR as the famous carbon. But if they are in fact contributing to this and there's a way to reverse it and it actually exists, we know about it, we can do it. It just needs more attention and a little bit of funding. And, you know, what's it going to take? And sadly, those questions do circle back to capitalistic structures and why these things aren't being implemented already. So it's hard to have the conversation about, you know, well, if it's so great and why aren't people doing it? We have a technology in our film that, you know, we get that question a lot. Well, why isn't it everywhere? And, you know, it's a deep rabbit hole of industries that have a strong hold. And like you say, we call things conventional agriculture that are really anything but, you know, why is the responsibility on organic to have to put that label on the food products? It should be the responsibility of conventional agriculture to label theirs as chemical food. You know, you shouldn't have to look for that. And these organic farms have to go out of their way and pay to get certified and this and that. It should be the exact opposite.
Yeah.
How do we transition more there is because we need to have that awareness. And so just talking about it in some ways can seem, you know, well, it's a big idea, but really the ideas are where these things do start, right? I mean, you can't have a grassroots movement that that changes anything unless people actually know about it and know how, why to care about it. That's why it's amazing that you do what you do, and that those of us who are trying to tell these stories keep that work going, because it will become more and more valued as humanity realizes, wow, you were kind of onto something there. You know, it wasn't just this nature loving hippy dippy, return to the land movement. It was actually the future of the planet. I mean, it's literally, are we going to save the Earth? I just don't know what else is more important than trying to save the world, right?
Yeah. And we've seen in my 30 years of doing this, a big change, because our original focus was on the impacts of animal agriculture on our world. Back then, even environmental organizations wouldn't acknowledge that it was a big factor. Now, everybody knows. You've got the burgers coming out that are out in order to address this issue. You've got ads all over the place for vegan and this and that. So it's become something that it wasn't 30 years ago. So yeah, it's late. Yeah, we're late on climate change. Yeah, we're late on topsoil. But it's true. We need to keep talking about it over and over and over again, because if we don't, it will never be part of the conversation. And yep. Got to be over and over again. This is Bob DiBenedetto on The Healthy Planet, 90.1 FM, WUSB, Stony Brook. I'm talking to Rob Herring, director and producer of the film, The Need to Grow. And the timing of this show couldn't be better, since we're in the middle of a global free screening event for the first time since the film was launched. So you can watch this important documentary film for free between now and September 14th. And you can do that by going to theneedtogrow.com. TheNeedToGrow.com. Rob, you mentioned Michael Smith's creation, and this is really interesting part of the film. He's a big thinker who created something called the Green Powerhouse, and it makes use of biological processes to accelerate the regeneration of soil, as well as a number of other things. Talk a little bit about what he did, what he is doing.
Yeah, thanks. You know, and for anybody who's been listening along, I want to say that, you know, as much as we've been nerding out about, you know, soil science and kind of a bit of the doom and gloom, our film is really focused on the characters and these beautiful human stories. And really, we lucked out in some ways, and we also were intentionally trying to create a hero's journey as similar to a scripted narrative as we possibly could, because, you know, it's storytelling that I think can change the world. And it's not a film that's focusing on just everything that's going wrong, but it's, you know, what are people actually doing? And it's not that their stories are a walk in the park. There's some really gut-wrenching drama. But it is hopeful, because you see that it's happening and that the solutions are out there. And so that was really our whole idea. When I first met with my co-director, Ryan Weirich, the very first time we ever communicated, and of course have become, you know, extremely close friends since, but the very first time that we ever sat down was he pitched me on this idea of doing a film about agriculture. And we arrived at, you know, we're not going to do it unless it's focused on solutions. And there's just too much out there already that's talking about the problems. And so we need to move into this next chapter. And so, you know, we were lucky, serendipity dropped this amazing human being into our laps by the name of Michael Smith. And when you watch the film, you see a bit about his backstory, and that he's actually been an inventor and kind of touched pop culture in so many different ways through the inventions that he's contributed to society, from creating the first digital 3D animation technology that was bought by Disney and used in movies like Aladdin and beyond, and the first 3D animated music videos, and working in video game AI, music, digital signal processing on things like Pink Floyd and the Beatles. I mean, it's just astounding when you see, wow, like, okay, you contributed this and this and this. But then the beautiful thing that our story is telling is how through that whole career, or the expertise that he's gained, he is now applying to natural systems communication. And this is what is so unique about him, because there's a lot of smart people out there doing AI and things like that, a lot of brilliant people in agriculture, but no one is doing quite what he has done in that combining these technology feedback communication. You know, this is, it's beyond my expertise, but the AI that you would see in a video game, let's say, that would have your computer generated soccer player pass you the ball back and forth in a cooperative manner, right? As we go and play the game, can we use those to actually have characters have elements of nature be as characters in a game so that they can communicate? And so he developed this technology that is really taking different biological processes and putting them together in a way that optimizes them, that has really never happened before in terms of this efficiency and the speed in which he does it. And a lot of that has to do because of his visionary mind of how he can use these control systems. And so he's created this beautiful cyclical closed loop process that is essentially turning waste into usable products, particularly electricity, and most importantly, these biostimulants or these soil regenerating compounds in the form of biochar and these liquid fertilizers that actually jumpstart the soil regeneration process in ways that would take so long in nature for to happen. But he's not hijacking nature in the same way of like a genetically modified food is. He's really just allowing it to work with itself and optimize the different processes to move faster. And so he's taking waste and turning it into something beautiful. And people, you know, for those who don't know, you know, our landfills are really the biggest contributor to emissions currently, and how much food we send into those landfills that rots and is not just producing carbon dioxide, but also methane and nitrous oxide. And so the degrading biomass that sits in our landfills, whether it's food waste or things like wood waste or other agricultural wastes, they can actually be turned back into biological inputs. So that's part of what his system does. And we explain it all better than I just did through, as you mentioned, some beautiful animations, and there's a lovely narration by our executive producer and narrator, Rosario Dawson. And it's an accessible form, I think, for most audience goers.
It is.
For something really scientific and nerdy, but actually how these types of technologies can contribute. And it's not meant to be, like I said, the one and only solution to solve everything. And that's why we focus on three different stories of varying degrees that I think represent, you know, different proportions of solution intervention. One of them is an 8-year-old girl and the work that she's doing on a local level. And the other one is this incredible renegade farmer who's doing urban agriculture. And they all could deserve their own independent films, but together, I think the idea for us was to show that it is about this interconnection, right? It's not just a solution. And we can't just rely on farmers, and we can't just rely on politicians or leaders, or there's no one person responsible. There's no one group, but it's actually that we all have the opportunity to step in wherever is best for us. And so to say, you know, do this or do that is really a bit, you know, small-minded. It's, you know, do the thing that is your next step. You know, what can you do? It could be just taking your food scraps and actually composting them for the first time. It could be starting your own mini garden for the first time. Maybe you've already done those things and your next step is to incorporate biochar or to, you know, start, writing to your congressman more and more and putting that pressure on, or fighting for chemical-free parks and schools. It's whatever it is for you. It's just take the step. Any step, whatever that next step is, that's what we need people to do. It's not, you know, do the green powerhouse. It's not become a regenerative farmer. And it's not, you know, start a school garden necessarily. But there's so many things to choose from. So I hope that people watch the film and think, hey, I could do something. If nothing else, this 8-year-old girl kind of takes the excuses away for most people, because when you see what she's doing in her community, it's like, okay, wow, I have no excuse.
That's just great.
Yeah, she's changing the world. And we all can. We all can be part of that.
Absolutely. You know, in my house, we've done the geothermal, so we're off heating oil, natural gas. We've done the solar, we're off the electricity. We've been vegan for decades. And now, just by chance, this past weekend, my wife spent the entire weekend almost researching our home garden. And so seeing this film and learning about the biochar and all this, perfect timing. It's really great.
I love that. Yeah, because you know, we all have the ability to do our own little soil carbon sequestration in our own backyards if we can, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's not just about these large scale, big monoculture farms and transitioning things that are going to be, you know, a bit challenging to change, but it's, hey, I've got a backyard. What can I do?
Right now, what can you do? Today, tomorrow, your next meal, the power is in our hands. So we're at the end of our time. Rob, any final thoughts you'd like to leave our audience with?
I hope that you guys can check out the film right now. It is totally free on our website, theneedtogrow.com. And in a way, you know, you'll see this underdog story that happens in this film. And for us, we experienced kind of a similar thing as filmmakers while we were making it. And it's part of why we decided to distribute the film in the way that we did, which was to just give it away to everyone. And we've seen just such beautiful response from around the world. The last time that we offered it for free in this way, we reached 175 countries on earth and had, you know, people writing in from all over that said, I just started composting for the first time, or here's a picture of, you know, my 5-year-old and we're doing our first garden, or, you know, my kid is eating a cucumber now because we grew it ourselves, right? And so changing our relationship to food is, I think, the entry point for people to change their relationship to the natural world at all. And if our story can help instigate or enable or encourage or inspire any positive change like that, I mean, it's just, you know, it's the most rewarding feeling for us. That's why we wanted to give it away. And I hope that you'll share it with friends and family and loved ones, because as we've seen in these past couple months, you know, humanity is in need of some big changes. And these things that we're talking about the environment are also really impactful on our human health. And they're really the same conversation. So as we're thinking about environmental health, it is human health. And when we're thinking about human health, it is environmental health. The same solutions for one are the solutions for the other.
Exactly. So
that's why food is the entry point. And The Need to Grow was titled that for a number of reasons. And one is that, you know, we just need to grow up as a species and face our responsibility as shepherds and how we interact with the ecosystems, because we are the earth, quite literally. You know, it's we're not separate. It's funny because the definition of nature in Webster's, I think, says like everything that's not human, basically, right? and it literally excludes humans from nature. And man, we need to break that belief. You know, we are part of the animal kingdom and we are part of nature. And if we destroy our home, well, then we're done. So yeah. let's celebrate the opportunity that we have each and every day to participate in the solutions. And yeah, I hope that the film can teach you a little bit about soil and why that's important, and we can move forward with this issue on the top of our minds.
That's great. And for those of you who have not seen the film yet, The Need to Grow, I would highly recommend it, as it gets you thinking about some of these very basic and key aspects of life on Earth. And it also follows various storylines, as Rob mentioned, that will get you emotionally involved in a positive way. And thanks for joining us, Rob Herring. And thank you for your years of work on this project to educate us and to lift up humanity going forward.
Such a pleasure, Bob. Thank you for the work that you're doing as well. Thank you to everybody who's been listening. And we're all in it together. So thanks for your time.
We sure are. This is Bob DiBenedetto on the Healthy Planet radio show on WUSB 90.1 FM, Stony Brook, New York. That was our discussion with Rob Herring, director and producer of the film The Need to Grow. And to repeat, you can watch this important film right now, between now and the 14th of September, for free. Just go to theneedtogrow.com, theneedtogrow.com. Thanks so much for listening to the Healthy Planet radio program. I'll be back with you again on Friday, October 2nd, at this same time. That's right, at 6 p.m. And between now and the next radio show, you'll hear great hosts from Dr. Eugene Zamperone to Beth Viteni, and that's happening again at 6 p.m. on Fridays. For more information on Healthy Planet and our radio shows, or if you're interested in having me do a virtual presentation to your school or group, visit our website at www.healthyplanetusa.org or email us to join our mailing list at info@healthyplanetusa.org. Also, like our Facebook page, which is at Healthy Planet USA. And until next time, stay strong, keep moving, even at home. Relax, make your voice heard in this world by continuing to speak up. Do what you can to build the soil. Be kind to those around us, including our amazing four-legged friends, and enjoy this beautiful world that we all share. Good night. The United Nations designated International Day of Peace and the start of Climate Week for Monday, September 21st. On that same day, Long Island Earth Day 2020 will host a virtual program featuring a dozen major local and regional environmental, peace, and justice groups. Pre-program plans include a small commemorative ceremony as organizers rededicate an historic peace pole installed at that very same location in 1990. That will take place on Sunday, September 20th, 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. at South Haven County Park, located along the Carmans River. Long Island Earth Day 2020 is a grassroots effort led by South Country Peace Group in collaboration with the Suffolk County Parks Department, joining 35 individuals and groups to initiate activities which will demonstrate our connection to and love for the Earth, our concern about the deadly harm we are doing to her, and the many ways in which our personal and joint actions can foster healing change. For updated information on this event, search Facebook for Long Island Earth Day 2020. That's Long Island Earth Day 2020. Get tapped in. There is no Planet B. Any group aligned with Long Island Earth Day's 2020 goals wishing to be an endorser of Long Island Earth Day 2020 may contact us by call or text at 631-523-4663. That's 631-523-4663. Or email southcountrypeacegroup@yahoo.com. southcountrypeacegroup@yahoo.com. Thank you for joining us and for taking action for the Earth.
Our climate is changing. Making a few changes to your driving habits can cut tailpipe emissions and improve fuel efficiency. Drive smart. Go easy on the brakes and gas pedal. Get regular tune-ups by following your vehicle's maintenance schedule. Check your tire pressure. Combine as many activities and errands into one trip as possible. Reduce your carbon impact to the environment. Act now on climate change.